The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with a special preview.
I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at the New Yorker. George Saunders is known for his short stories. He's the author of the collections 10th of December, In Persuasion Nation, Pastoralia, and others. Many of his stories deal with characters who are economically or socially or ethically on the margins of American life, who feel anxious about their prospects, people who might, in real life, be fans of Donald Trump. So we asked Saunders to take on a nonfiction assignment for the magazine, reporting from Trump's campaign trail. Saunders attended rallies and events around the country, listening to speeches and talking with both supporters and protesters, and he recorded some of his encounters.
Trump is racist, so are you! Trump is racist, so are you! Trump is racist, so are you!
So, George, that clip we just heard came from a video you took at one of the Trump rallies you attended. Can you set the scene for us a little?
Yeah, I'm just having a flashback. I have to take a little moment. this was, I think, outside the convention center in Tucson, and that's the rally where the guy in the Klan robe got punched in the head. So I think that was as the rally was letting out, and the game is kind of that the protesters will set up as close as they can around a doorway so that as the Trump people come out, there's this kind of river and riverbank sort of confrontation that happens. So that I think that's what we're hearing there. But I think it becomes a bit of performance art. You know, if I can provoke you into saying something really rude to me or pushing me or hitting me, then I have a sense that that's going to go on the news that night. You know, so to a certain extent, it's performance. And when you actually look at it, you know, if you could sort of pan out, 85% of the people are sitting there checking their phones or making plans for lunch. And then somewhere over here, two people are suddenly fighting. And then the whole rally goes over there. And everybody's filming everybody else.
So initially we talked about this piece and you agreed to take it on.
Big mistake.
You're a fiction writer.
Yeah.
And what was the motive for you there?
Well, really, I've just finished a novel, and I was kind of feeling happy and celebratory, and I thought it'd be fun to take a shot at this. And so I agreed to it, and then almost immediately saw that I was, you know, in over my head. I'm not really that political of a person, and I've been kind of following it loosely. And then I would say the first rally I went to, I realized that this was going to be a huge undertaking. And I think early on in a couple drafts I did, I was trying so hard to be fair to the Trump supporters that I was kind of missing the element of danger in it.
Well, you know, in your fiction, you often are writing about sort of social underdogs and people in dire straits economically or with work or all of these things. Do you think that that helped you kind of find a point of sympathy or compassion?
Well, at first it hurt me because I think what I learned about myself personally was that I tend to do empathy pretty well. You know, the kind of habitual moves that I do in fiction where I will make somebody who's kind of a dope and then spend a year or so looking closer to see if I can find any redeeming virtues. That's a good approach for, I'd say, you know, some large percentage of human beings. But in this story, it got into the place where what do you do when someone has an idea that's hurtful to other people and dangerous? You take your natural empathy into that, and the danger is that you'll do what the Buddhists call idiot compassion, you know, which is to be so anxious to be empathetic that you don't push back or you don't call a spade a spade. If someone is doing something reprehensible, sometimes you just have to say, that sucks, cut it out. So in a way, all those bad drafts are me trying to not confront that issue. But it was really challenging. Because Trump, you know, the thing about Trump is he's, if you want to write about race or gender or class or the media, almost anything you want to write about, Trump is kind of this incredible, like, locus of all these weird American energies.
And yet, everything that he spouts is kind of a black and white one-liner.
Yeah. You know, in teaching creative writing, you notice that a student will often critique a piece very broadly. You know, your piece sucks, Leonard, and it's boring. Well, that's not any good as a critique. It's hurtful. It's vague. But as we become better critics, we improve in specificity. So in the end, the thing is more detailed and less hurtful and more actionable. So that helped me break the code a little bit. Essentially, Trump's thing is a rhetorical wrongness. There's a vagueness in his proposals that I think has to do with bad projection on his part. You know, when you get the sense that when a Trump supporter says undocumented person or illegal, there's something coming up there that doesn't match reality. You know, in reality, the number of border crossings into the U.S. from Mexico have decreased over the last few years. The immigrant population commits less crime than the native population. But there's a bad projection. So we could call that bad literary imagining.
Now, you yourself grew up in a relatively working class environment. You've lived in some red states. You, even at the rallies, you were sometimes mistaken for a Trump supporter based on your looks, and one guy accused you of belonging to the KKK. What do you think it is, if there is something, that separates you sort of politically or ethically from these people that you were writing about?
You know, for me, the challenge of this piece was to try to see, well, is there some essential difference between us and them? So if you can occupy the mind of the Trump supporters, you see that they're not stupid, and it's not to them at all an irrational position. It's actually quite rational. And when they talk to you about their lives over the last 5 or 10 years, you see that the liberal idea that they're dummies or they're just misinformed isn't quite complicated enough. The other thing I think a lot of Trump supporters are feeling is a kind of a racial nostalgia, you know, a kind of feeling that the demographics of the country are shifting. A lot of things that used to come to them pretty easily are now not, or they have this sense that they're being usurped in some way. And that causes a lot of anxiety. That was maybe the hardest thing to talk about in this piece, because you can't deny that there's a racial element to the anxiety that they feel. On the other side, it's very easy to call it, they're all racist. That didn't seem quite true to me. I had an interesting moment. There's a woman named Marianne Mendoza whose son, Brandon, was a police officer in Mesa. And it sounds like just a wonderful guy, you know, like really involved in the community and kind of a dream police officer. And he was killed by an undocumented Mexican guy who was wasted, and they both died in this car accident. And so she gave a speech at the Fountain Hills rally. And it was such a moving speech, and you could just, you know, feel her pain in her voice. And there was a moment where I was sitting there going, oh my God, I'm becoming a convert. You know, this woman makes total sense to me. Maybe I've been wrong all along. So it was an interesting thing to kind of be pushed out of your liberal comfort zone. When you get out of there, it's kind of terrifying, because you see that the opposing mindset is just as sure of itself as we're sure of ourselves. You know, you become less hopeful that real communication could happen.
You went to a lot of rallies and saw a lot of arguments and altercations, some of which got physically violent, like the one in San Jose, California in early June. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I went to the San Jose rally and was inside the auditorium and heard Trump's speech and had some nice talks with Trump supporters, and then went out and basically walked out into this riot that broke out. And at one point was kind of standing in a crowd of protesters. And one of the things about this rally that struck me was the protesters were outnumbering the Trump supporters because of the way they routed the people out of the building. So there was a crowd of people, and there were a few, maybe two or three Trump supporters standing there kind of mouthing off. And there was one woman, probably maybe a little older than me, maybe in her 60s, kind of a, to me, she looked like sort of a Northern California ranch woman or something. And she was arguing with this group of young women. And it got kind of ugly. And one of the women reached over and grabbed her sign. And there was some shoving. And then there was a slap. And the woman who had slapped was a young African-American woman. And I kind of pushed her away and said, you know, this really is not what you want to do. If you like I am, I'm against Trump, this is the last thing you want to give that campaign to work with. So she kind of came to herself and was a little bit moved by this. And then, you know, I went back and there was really quickly another slap. And it happened pretty quickly, but I think the woman's glasses were knocked off and she ended up down on one knee. So at that point, I just kind of, you know, kind of quickly got her up and we went off through the police line and then kind of just stood there, you know, kind of two middle-aged people kind of shocked that this had happened. And then I kind of just said, you know, she looked shaken up, as I'm sure I did. And I said, well, before you go home, just sit in the car and take a few breaths. She said, okay. And then about 15 minutes later, I'd gone back in and I saw her kind of on the edge of the crowd, almost like morbidly fascinated. She couldn't leave. She was kind of maybe edging her way back into the crowd a little bit.
Did you find you changed your mind about anything in the course of doing this?
I'm afraid to say no. No, I didn't. I think, well, I'll tell you what I became convinced of was, and this might be a little corny, but it's true, that I became convinced of the existential value of gentleness, meaning when you engage in a political discussion, the importance of having some baseline curiosity, some intention of maintaining affection for the person, some sense that their views are as valid as yours, that they're just as real as a human being as you are, and of the kind of the sacred quality of whatever institutional things protect that space. So I guess we call it civility. That I think was the biggest thing, that there are ways for people across the divide to talk, but we're forgetting them pretty quickly, I think. And then also I think, you know, in a certain way, from a novelistic perspective, what was kind of sublime, I don't know if I call it beautiful, but is the way that this one guy who, you know, to me seems like he's had an incredibly privileged, strange, wealthy life that most of us can't even imagine. I mean, the kind of distortion reality field he must live in, the mysterious means by which that person is now giving off energy that's rippling through every place in our culture, that's a really interesting dynamic. And it has something to do with, of course, big media, you know, reality TV. But that sort of idea of action at a distance was really interesting and kind of frightening. And I think our understanding of it is way behind the pace at which it's being enacted.
Do you think that if Trump were elected, that all of these people going out in support of him, do you think their lives would improve?
No. No, I think they would get much worse. And, you know, the other thing is that if he doesn't get elected, this was maybe my kind of mantra throughout was, if he doesn't get elected, these emotions that I observed, they don't go away. And in fact, you know, you'd have to say if Hillary gets elected, they're going to be aggravated over the next 4 years. So at least for me, it was very surprising to see the amount of grievance, the sense that America is totally messed up. That surprised me, and that's not going away.
So many of the people that you encountered probably register a kind of chip on their shoulders about the sort of liberal media and this kind of left-wing liberal mindset that's prevalent in mainstream media, you know, what Trump often decries. Do you feel that you were seen as representing that? Do you feel that you were maybe sort of turning that whole attitude around and that the same thing could be said of you?
My idea was to kind of go in incognito and just hang out. But invariably, there'd be somebody standing next to you at a rally and you start talking. And my impulse was always to kind of confess and say, you know, I have to say I'm a liberal. And even that would get such a funny reaction. It would be almost like I'm a Martian, you know. and so that was actually a great way to kick off. You'd say, yeah, I'm a liberal. I'm kind of, you know, I'm left of Gandhi. And they would kind of, you know, look at me in a little disbelief and start laughing. And then we'd have a great conversation based on that fact that, you know, okay, I'm a liberal. Let's see, you know, what we can talk about. And I had a great conversation with these guys in Wisconsin. We were the rally was being held in a convention center that was kind of hooked into this mall. So we were standing in line, and it was clear we weren't going to get in. And we were in front of a bridal shop. So we had this big, long, mansplainy conversation between the four or five of us. And there were these three mannequins in prom dresses that were kind of looking at us the whole time. But we had this really kind of wonderful discussion about kind of, they were sort of like libertarians more than Trump supporters, but they were there kind of out of curiosity. And it occurred to me that if you could enact that conversation a million times across America, you might actually change something. Because what was happening was we were bored. We had nowhere to go. It was a kind of a fun conversation. We seemed to get along.
What did you talk about?
Well, I think I was just asking them again, you know, why would you consider supporting this guy? And this was a particularly Wisconsin-y kind of conversation. They were all about overregulation. That was their thing. And so it was a really wide-ranging, goofy conversation with lots of kind of mock fighting and stuff. But there were moments in these conversations where suddenly you'd find yourself having burned through all the BS. You would say, you know, I actually don't know that. Do you guys know about that statistic? No, we don't know. Hmm. Huh. Interesting. It'd be good to know this factoid. Or you would come to some place where you'd be talking about immigration, for example. And I happen to have a couple of particular stories about particular immigrants that you could drop. And at that point, you could see the conversation would become suddenly serious. It would become more respectful because there was an actual human being that was being discussed. And it would become more befuddled, which I came to see as a sign of authenticity. When people say, yeah, that's a tough one, I really don't know. That moment seemed to me really promising. But it doesn't happen without hours of kind of pointless discussion.
People think they know for hours and then reach the point of not knowing.
Yeah, it takes a long time to burn that stuff off.
That was George Saunders. You can find his reporting from the Trump campaign and many of his short stories as well at NewYorker.com. His first novel, Lincoln and the Bardo, will be published next year.